So wait just a second. Okay. Okay, welcome everyone to this teach-in on transliteration. I hope you can all hear me. By our London comrade, Nuncia Faes, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is currently based in London at the London School of Economics, and before that obtained a BA degree in Visual and Critical Studies at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and is a student of Chris Cotrone. This is a teach-in hosted by the Platypus Society, which, for those of you who are not acquainted with us, is an international organization that was founded as a result of the critique of the on the left of the anti-Iraq war movement in 2006, early 2007. The project is dedicated to investigating the death of the left through educating young people, generally people, on the history of Marxism through our reading groups, coffee breaks, and public fora. The latter public fora, and together with our PR, which is in the back, serve as a forum of hosting the conversation on the left. With this, we aim to challenge currently existing thought taboos and dogmas inflicting the current left, which is at an historical impasse at the current moment. And as a poignant example of this, could be seen the Trump debate that is currently that's an ongoing debate we also host in the PR. So you can see in the latest issue of the PR, we ask, like, why not? Do you have it there? No? Okay. But you can find this online. We are trying to investigate this phenomenon and ask, why not Trump, in an honest manner. And we deem this, our activities, to be of the utmost necessity for creating the conditions of the possibility of socialist politics in the future. The collapse and the bankruptcy of the old left into Stalinism, and the failure and rather the very limited attempt of the new left and their followers, the post-political left in the 80s and 90s, have further obscured and suspended the need of reconsidering the failure of mostly the Second International and later on the Stalinization of the Third International. And we are here to undogmatically and in an honest spirit investigate these failures, for we think there is no way out of the capitalist crisis without seriously investigating and like really rethinking what the problems of the left were and are today. For we think the left is dead and is at a very bad impasse at the current historical moment, but we see that we need to come out of the capitalist crisis through socialist politics. And if you like to receive further information, you can come talk to us later on, or you can feel free to take the PR or sign up for the email list. And I'll just read your description, okay?
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. There's currently a reading group on Marxism and Anarchism Wednesday night. It's the first to the Second International, which was the break. The Marxist
it's
with the Anarchist.
The first to the Second International.
Okay, it's from the first to the Second International. Wednesday night happening here.
Room K3.
6
p.m. to 9 p.m. Everyone who's interested is invited. You can just jump to the train right now if you've missed the first two sessions.
What's going to be read next week?
Next week is Kautsky.
Kautsky.
Social Revolution Part 1 and 2.
Okay.
You can
okay.
find flyers for the reading group also next to the PR if you're interested. Sorry for the interruption.
Don't worry. Thank you. Okay. The political and cultural left, which have stood for increasing the scope of freedom, have historically shifted positions on issues of gender and sexuality. For instance, where once the left challenged gender and family norms in society, there has been a turn to advocation participation in predominant institutions, for instance, in legal reforms and the medical industry. There has been some conflict in the LGBTQ circles, over the politics of the trans identity, whether it should be considered a subjective development or an objective condition, and further, if it should be considered at all by the left. What do such controversies tell us about the politics of sexual freedom and the history of the left moving forward? How are issues of sexual freedom related to issues in the greater society and not of concern merely to sexual minorities and subcultures? Is there simply a need to be recognized as present, as expressed by queer nation? Or might we look forward to a renewed political disputes around issues of sexual freedom? What can history teach us about this? Which way forward for trans liberation? Which way forward for human emancipation? Mm-hmm. Okay, with that.
Yeah, so I just want to make like two disclaimers. The first is that I'm feeling a bit sick, so if I'm not speaking loud enough, please tell me to speak up. The second is that I've kind of prepared a short talk that like I've really only worked on it in the past like 3 or so days. So forgive me, and if you like need to interrupt, want me to slow down, please also do that. Or if you have like a longer point or a contestation, save it for the discussion, I guess, because I would welcome that. The topic of trans liberation today is taboo, and perhaps it is most taboo where it appears the most positively. For instance, in the activities and lifestyles of Cece McDonald, Caitlyn Jenner, and Laverne Cox. The discontent implied by its appearance is only truly detested and repressed where it appears most affirmed. And so when the issue of Rachel Dolezal, who claimed to be transracial, broke out, the practitioners of identity politics were indeed thrown for a loop. The attempts to bring transformation to one's own identity on an individual level are based on an attempt to go back to an apparently more stable social reality that had already been superseded. They are thus indicative of an unfree social totality in which one cannot realize themselves. Freud's insights into the unconscious are indicative of the constitutive aspects of this dynamic, in which libidinal energy can actually choose the ego as its object in both constitutive and pathological ways. The politics based on identity as such, however, would be pathological, since they would attempt to return to a previous state, an identity, which cannot be historically justified and cannot grasp the way forward for their own realization beyond that return to the identity. It is for this reason that in speaking of trans liberation today, I hope to avoid contributing to the reservoir of fractured experiences which characterizes this trans identity, which has been accumulated by two tendencies, both those series auxiliary to and descriptive of the suffering existence of trans people, which have always overextended their reach into the pre-capitalist world of mythology, as well as those theories focused on the epistemological justification and congenital or originary nature of the trans identity as a concept, which have been more or less consciously used to rationalize the degree to which trans people should be socially integrated on the basis that sex itself is a pathology. I cannot offer a third standpoint, but rather will attempt to carry out an imminent critique of the historical movement for trans liberation as it appears from the standpoint of the present. The atavistic poetics, which once inspired the elaboration of one's individual life outside work, instead today appear before one as an imperative to be followed. Leslie Feinberg's 1992 pamphlet, Transgender Liberation, A Movement Whose Time Has Come, is indicative of this tendency. The boundary is blurred between the advances of enlightenment and the patriarchal societies which superseded the ancient communal cultures, in which what was once called gender inversion was more present as a spiritual motif. To grasp the limitations of this understanding, one only needs to think of the castration required of males in many Paleolithic groups to become part of a spiritual caste. Let us recall that in Okinawa, the process of winagonati was used by male shaman to become female, or that in South Asia, the hijra undergo a similar process in order to participate in the rituals of their community. We could also recall the Muches, a third sex still found in Oaxaca today. Oaxaca's in Mexico, who typically live with their mothers for their entire lives in order to perform those productive tasks which seem best suited to them, namely domestic labor. Or we can consider the historic role of the two-spirit genders in the Pacific Northwest, whereby women could become women-men as hunters, and men could become men-women by performing domestic labor. In the view expanded by Feinberg, transgenderism, permitted by its vague aesthetic resemblance to this matriarchal past, is held up as something which has not yet been integrated into capitalism, and even against it. Her idea that transgenderism predates oppression is not easily permitted when one considers the closed spiritual nature of this communal life. Even the Christian punishment of homosexuality by castration commands a similar level of conformity to the existential community and takes on the same material appearance as those rituals practiced in past matriarchal societies, or rather groups, sorry. This aspect of existential conformity can be contrasted to what had happened after the repealment of this punishment against sodomy by the National Assembly in 1791 and its subsequent spread across Europe with the Napoleonic Code. The use of castration as a means of transforming oneself to meet their emotional and erotic needs was not abolished, but however liberated from an overwrought and oppressive function, and indeed obviated for many. This historical distinction between those for whom the need of castration was made unnecessary, that is, homosexuals and transvestites, and those who still desire it, which is transsexuals, will be addressed later. What is important to grasp at the moment is that this emancipation from necessity is alighted by the more recent strain of theorists on the subject, who locate the trans identity as authentically outside of capitalism. Some theorists, such as Jack Halberstam, point to the ways in which trans individuals today may be subject to dangerous and precarious lives, lacking access to jobs, education, healthcare, and family, that is, their lack of integration, as proof of the fact their existence is genuinely opposed to capitalism, and in fact encourages them to embody this lack of integration and take up other unintegrated spaces, such as abandoned housing, to further resist capitalism. This is complementary to the 1990 Queer Nation Manifesto, which states, "Every day you wake up alive, relatively happy and a functioning human being, you are committing a rebellious act. You, as an alive and functioning queer, are revolutionary." This is echoed in the Queer Nation slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." This amounts to an indignant rejection of the First Enlightenment, in which the transformation of the relationship of man and nature became conscious in the relations of labor, as well as a moral imperative to venerate the deplorable circumstances in which many have not been integrated within such social relations. Such imperatives to be rely on the fractured state of the world as it is. It is true that despite themselves, they appeal to the longing that the world was different. But upon carrying out the imperative to simply be the potential the potential to change is liquidated. Therefore, these imperatives must promote themselves on the basis of their own language. Feinberg expresses this clearly when she claims that the task at hand for trans liberation is to forge a common language in order to define and unify many different kinds of people who may consider themselves to be transgender. The moral contestation of the radical feminists, who have been baptized with the epitaph trans-exclusionary, who make similar claims for the authenticity of femininity as does Feinberg about the authenticity of transgenderism, only further obscures the situation by inspiring a defense from trans activists. For instance, Sandy Stone, in her 1993 essay, The Post-Transsexual Manifesto, claimed that viewing transition as a language allowed for the dismantling of the concept of gender itself. And it is from such strains of thought that we may find the trite aesthetic effects of disruption in so-called trans art, which for the milieu we have just been speaking of, dates back to the 1997 Trans Central exhibit organized by Jody Jones, in which the term trans itself was first coined, as opposed to the previous medical and epistemological concepts. These understandings, which I just elaborated, have tended to reject the labor and the extension of the concept, specifically the concept of gender. The existence of gender and the concept of gender remain artfully undifferentiated, and so performing the disruption of language of gender, or the disruption of gender, i.e. performing trans, as they would put it, appears to be beyond both its existence and its concept. And yet the actual practice of the linguistic performances require the acceptance of the concept and existence of gender as they have historically appeared as a given. Causes reverse its effect. Gender appears to be as involuntary as biological sex. For these reasons, the question most commonly phrased as, what does trans mean, may already assume too much. It requires the very suspension between the concept and existence of gender it rebels against. It projects the past mythology which cannot be historically justified, and creates a language which it must enact or perform, so as to continue avoiding the actual social manifestations of gender in both the past and present. Within this understanding, identity appears always inherent in us in ways that are beyond our volition, and even prior to our existence. In order to legitimize the trans identity without addressing the taboo of sexuality, i.e. that one has acquired the desire to transition out of a choice because of their own emotional and erotic needs, one must ultimately treat sex as a pathology, that one was assigned the wrong sex, so to speak. It is not enough to acknowledge or to recognize the shock that this resembles the barbarism of the Christian era, in which castration was the penalty for acts of sodomy. Dark humor aside, we must recognize the difference between this and what was permitted by the economics of the bourgeois revolution. In the bourgeois social relations of labor, laborers are free in two ways. First, to have the freedom to look for a job, that is, the ability to sell our labor power in return for wages from anyone willing to buy it. Laborers are also freed from the ownership of anything except our labor power. Laborers do not produce what they need, but rather have to work for a living in order to survive. As John D'Amelio writes in Capitalism and the Gay Identity, as wage labor spread and production became socialized, then it became possible to release sexuality from the imperative to procreate. Ideologically, heterosexual expression came to be a means of establishing intimacy, promoting happiness, and experiencing pleasure, and divesting the household of its economic independence and fostering the separation of sexuality from procreation, capitalism has created conditions that allow some men and women to organize a personal life around their erotic and emotional attraction to their own sex. Free individuals could work for a period of time so as to elaborate their own needs and interests in their free time, namely the development of one's own personal sexual desires and needs. For the sake of illustration, we can recall the emergence of the Molly houses, effeminate male brothels in the 18th century, or the rich personal life of actress Charlotte Clark and her female lovers, or Dr. James Barry, a male surgeon in the British Army who was discovered only after his death to be a biological female, among many other examples. What permitted the sexual liberation of the 18th and 19th centuries was not the discovery of new innate identities, but rather the development of social relations which caused the disintegration of the private family, allowing people to organize their personal lives to their own emotional erotic needs. The religious reaction to this sexual liberation that developed in the 19th century, for instance, in the establishment of the sodomy laws in German states that had been previously under the Napoleonic Code in Prussia and Austria, was also a consequence of this disintegration of the private family life in capitalism. It was in the second half of the 19th century, especially in Germany, that communities of individuals who shared similar sexual behaviors organized and described themselves around the concepts theorized by medical doctors. Much of the conceptual theorizing in this direction has done more to obscure the issue, even against its best intentions. From the German psychiatrist Carl Friedrich Otto Wittfall's discovery of the contrary sexual feeling in 1869, to the activist Carl Heinrich Ulrich's description of earnings or gender inverts as having a feminine brain and a masculine body, or a masculine brain and a female body. These attempts were not new scientific breakthroughs, but were responses to new ways of organizing one's personal life. It was at this time that the terms of the homosexual, as opposed to the transvestite and the transsexual, were hashed out. Each of these new categories, and gender inversion in general, were understood to be an innate condition, a view most recently put forward by psychobiologists, and more popularly by the slogan, "Born This Way." However, as Freud recognized, actual experience tells us something different, that the inversion is a consequence of an acquired, not the natural character of the sexual instinct. From the psychodynamic view, In the case of inversion, it appears that the sexual instincts and the sexual object are attempted to be brought closer together, as was the case in early childhood, in which the child treats himself as a sexual object, that is, autoerotically. Infantile sexuality, characterized by mechanical excitation, muscular activity, and affective processes, and which connects to the four pleasures, is retained within the genital pleasure, which is the aim of the four pleasures. To state this more simply, the aim of the return is the finding of an object. It was for this reason, then, that Freud acknowledged the significance of Ferenczi's assertion that there were two types of inverts, subject homoerotics, who feel and behave like women, and object homoerotics, who are completely masculine and have merely changed a female for a male object. This distinction became apparently necessary, not because of an innate pathological difference between the two forms of sexual instinct, but rather because of a social need to distinguish between the two that had developed. By as early as 1910, some men would use hormone replacement, self-castration, facial hair epilation, and paraffin injections into their breasts in order to appear as the other sex. While as early as 1912, women would use breast and uterus removal to live the life of a man. It was responding to this need that Magnus Hirschfeld, the activist and sexologist who was the leader of the German homosexual emancipation movement, distinguished homosexual from transvestite along congruent terms. While homosexuals merely found love objects of the same sex, transvestites felt and behaved as the opposite sex. Transsexuals, he would later assert, were those who would practice a surgical change to become the other sex. For Hirschfeld, all of these conditions were considered congenital and as such natural. This cannot be understood separately from his own political arguments for the rights of homosexual individuals and transvestites. Hirschfeld claimed that these groups deserved rights on the basis that the conditions they had were not a choice, but were entirely natural. What's lost in abandoning the logic of the ego, that these desires are acquired from the particular historical development of the individual and his sexual instincts, is the social aspect of sexuality, that sexuality is acquired and socially mediated. In 1896, Magnus Hirschfeld had established the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, which demanded to repeal paragraph 175, the sodomy law in the Prussian Empire. The committee put forward a petition in 1898 advocating the repealment of paragraph 175, signed by August Bebel, the shadow emperor of the Social Democratic Party, and Karl Kautsky, the highly influential Marxist intellectual of the SPD, among other members from their own party and other parties, and further, by people from literary and academic circles, jurists, psychologists, and experts of the highest rank in their fields, including the likes of Albert Einstein. Although this attempt was not successful, it provided Hirschfeld's movement with early momentum and foreshadowed 30 years early the repealment of the paragraph in 1929. Of course, that repealment was reversed in 1932. Transvestites and transsexuals lacked a similarly prominent legal hurdle to organize around. Instead, they faced a constellation of obstacles. This was not only limited to the access for many transvestites and transsexuals to proficient surgical tools and skills. These obstacles also included the 19th century laws concerning gross mischief and creating a public nuisance, paragraphs 360, 11, and 183, respectively, of the Reich Code, or Penal Code. However, rather than tackle these obstacles on a legal level, Hirschfeld and his colleagues, particularly psychoanalyst Carl Abraham, organized the integration of transvestites and transsexuals within the state bureaucracy. In 1908, Hirschfeld and Abraham had successfully convinced the Berlin municipal government and its police to issue their transvestite patients certificates and passports to those individuals with approved medical documentation. These transvestite certificates showed that the bearer was known to police and was not guilty of Unfug nonsense. We can see here already how Hirschfeld, in his attempt to integrate transvestites and transsexuals within society, has required the pathologization of these individuals. The revolutionary years between 1917 and 1919 affected Hirschfeld deeply and gave him insurmountable hope for sexual liberation. In November of 1918, Hirschfeld wrote in his journal, "From our standpoint, the great revolution of the last week can only be greeted with joy. The new era brings us freedom of speech and publication, and with the liberation of all who were formerly oppressed, we may with certainty assume that those upon whose behalf we have worked for so many years will also receive an equitable assessment." Do you want me to reread that quote again, or?
No.
Hirschfeld's hopes for the revolution were ultimately liberal. However, his assessment speaks true to the fact that only a socialist revolution could have fulfilled and realized these liberal ideals. That is, what Hirschfeld recognized could only be true if society could transform itself such that labor and the forces of production, the objectified accumulation of historical productive knowledge, could both be liberated. Hirschfeld notably took the establishment of the Weimar Republic as an achievement along this continuum, despite the failure of the attempted revolution in January the next year. With the removal of the Prussian state and the relaxing of obscenity laws, which were the consequence of the establishment of the liberal government in 1919, Hirschfeld was able to continue his work by developing the Institute for Sexual Research. In 1919, the liberal state led to the development of new positions within the state bureaucracy. The police relinquished some of their authority to social workers, allowing for the establishment of legal name changes for Hirschfeld's patients. By 1920, the Institute had carried out its first male-to-female surgery. In 1922, the Berlin municipal government decided to change their enforcement of the penal paragraphs 360, 11, and 183 by issuing a new procedural guideline which reiterated that wearing clothes of the opposite sex was not to be considered illegal unless prostitution was involved. Despite the fact that Hirschfeld's policy reforms were mired in the swamp of the bourgeois democracy of the Weimar Republic, the scientific contributions of the Institute for Sexual Research, which contributed not only to the knowledge of sex operation, but venereal diseases and sexual health in general, bequeathed a significant amount of knowledge to the Russians. The Soviet Union sent delegates to the Institute for Sexual Research and international conferences facilitated by Hirschfeld and his colleagues. By contrast, in Russia, legal hurdles were being overcome. Since the early 1920s, in the European regions or urban centers of Russia, it had become regular, though tenuous, to request and be granted an operative and lawful sex change. These individuals were able to gain legal family rights as well. When a female-to-male transsexual, Evgeny Fedorovich, married a female postal worker in 1922, a Soviet court decreed that the marriage was legal. This was not a fluke, but was the typical outcome for such individuals within the Red Army, in the factories, and in party organizations. However, the vulgar Marxist tendency of the late revolution led people to regard male effeminization as bourgeois decadence. That is, since it appeared that industrial labor required the kind of masculinity typical of industrial society, large muscles, oily hair, etc. The idea that this form of labor could be transformed such that other sexes could participate in social labor, developing and elaborating their physique as they desired, was elided. In the 1930s, all of these efforts were reversed with the introduction of an official government censorship of homosexual themes. Soviet medical expert Suresky wrote in the Great Soviet Encyclopedia in 1930 that Soviet legislation does not recognize so-called crimes against morality. Our laws proceed from the principle of protection of society and therefore countenance punishment only in those instances where juveniles and minors are the object of homosexual interest. While recognizing the incorrectness of homosexual development, our society combines prophylactic and other therapeutic measures with all the necessary conditions for making the conflicts that afflict homosexuals as painlessly as possible and for resolving their typical estrangement from society within the collective. The behaviors associated with gender inversion were thus deemed to be pathological and thus undesirable on the same scientific basis for which their integration into the Weimar Republic state bureaucracy was argued. So I'm just making a comparison between what ended up happening under Stalinism and what happened in the 1920s in the Weimar Republic, saying that it was made on the same scientific basis that these conditions are somehow pathological. This appeal to sexual identities as inherent, indicative of both the Soviet Union and the Weimar Republic, relies on the contradiction between the conceptual law, either with regards to science or jurisprudence on one hand, and what the law conceptualizes. As scientific knowledge acquires increasing control over the details of social existence, of sexuality in particular, it has lost likewise the progressive possibility of gaining intellectual control of society as a totality, losing the qualifications it could potentially have for the leadership of society. The constitutively, rather than pathologically, narcissistic character of the abnormal sexualities that psychology attempted to grasp at the turn from the 19th to the 20th century reflect, in which the individual treats their own body as an object. I'm just saying that this actually resembles the egoism of Kant's formalistic ethics, which enabled the individual to understand the possibility of a metaphysical solution to the problem of the thing in itself, by enabling concepts of the world seen as a totality to arise as possibilities of practical reason. So I'm making a comparison between the way in which abnormal sexualities might be like unconscious solutions to complexes in early childhood, but which by practicing, by like putting those to practice in a sublimated way, one can obviate the necessity of that complex. So the individual is able to understand a solution to their unconscious sexual instincts by cathecting libidinal energy in constitutive practical ways. Grasping the principle of praxis, the relationship of theory to practice, allows the attempt to resolve the apparent contradiction between concept and being. Politics, on the basis of a naturalized identity, whether it is the case of Ulrich, Hirschfeld, or Feinberg, is indicative of the inability of theory and practice to be socially mediated. The more recent cases of this tendency of social integration, which have developed since the 1960s, can be exemplified by the conceptual thought of Hirschfeld's student, Harry Benjamin, who developed the categories of true transsexual and narcissistic transvestite in order to only give transitional hormones and surgery to those who had exhibited the correct pathology and the corresponding fracture of the trans movement between transvestites who only dress as the opposite sex, transgender people who only pass socially as another sex, and transsexuals who undergo a sex change operation. All of these cases are indicative of an unfree and irrational totality, namely indicative of the degradation of the liberal framework which gives rise to them. The solution to this problem of the irrational totality would not be able to be found in more conceptualizations, which would further reaffirm the contradiction, whether they are empirical or edificatory. Rather, this solution would have to be found in praxis, namely in realizing the need for a total transformation of society. Ironically, the practice of sexual transitioning is an attempt to stay the same, necessarily and constitutively, to return libidinal energy to oneself. From the view of the individual psychic level, this may result in the interplay of the sexual instincts, aiding in the drive to find objects, and thus lead to the fulfillment of pleasure and pursuit of happiness. The necessity for politics on this basis, however, only corresponds to the regression of society behind the liberal advances of enlightenment, and so it could only amount to the liberal demand for bourgeois right, namely, the changing of identity documents to allow easier access to job opportunities, fair and equal use of public restroom facilities, fair housing, equal military service, fair family law, such as custody and marriage, fair and accessible education, access to health care, personal safety, fair employment, and safety and access to health care for immigrants and those in correctional facilities. The amazement that we are still experiencing these things in the 21st century is not enough to compel us to the consideration of the practical overcoming of the situation which has produced these experiences in the first place. That would require us to go beyond the given concepts, not through the truth of the language speaking itself, but in transforming the way society is mediated. The only politics adequate to emancipate trans people would be a politics which could overcome and emancipate labor on one hand, so that all people, not only trans people, have access to work and are not overworked, but also to emancipate the forces of production, so that they may be owned socially, so that the individual may live as richly and fully to a corresponding degree as the richness and fullness of humanity's productive knowledge. The recognition of the necessity of this can only be actualized by the organized efforts of those who are responsible for reproducing this situation, the proletariat, to overcome this situation. It is only through a proletarian movement towards socialism that the bourgeois ideals, which are today degraded, could be fully realized. The division of the working class indicated by the wage gap between men and women and the lack of access to the rights of work that oppresses trans people is a problem for the development of such a politics. The popular form of identity politics today is thus also an obstacle for socialist politics, because it is based on the innate separation between people along the fractured state of bourgeois social relations. It is for this reason that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton can make appeals to trans interests. For instance, both have come out against the North Carolina bathroom bill in favor of free access to bathrooms for trans people. However, Trump expresses this appeal more fully, as Clinton only claims to express or understand the suffering of trans people, while Trump offers to give them jobs. Trump's appeal does not offer anything particular to each identity, but expresses the necessity to work to participate in society that is universal to all. Socialism similarly cannot offer anything particular to any group or any particular creed. It can only offer the emancipation of all of humanity. The successes of the German and Russian revolutions in the way of sexual freedom was not luck, but was because of the development of a political crisis in the form of a revolutionary mass political party. By contrast, the most salient practical considerations implied by contemporary trans activism, as it finds expression in both the Republican and Democratic parties, are at best an increase of state representation and protections accomplished through redistribution of wealth and the creation of new jobs, which would simply create new forms of capital. However, the development of these new forms of capital could create opportunities for the reconstitution of the left. Both Trump and Sanders' ability to organize a new constituency of voters who are interested in politics and the right to work is indicative of this potential. This consideration of capital's revolutionary character, that it makes labor superfluous and unnecessary, and produces the proletariat who could consciously overcome this historical dynamic, is elided by contemporary trans politics, and instead, identity is taken as a standpoint. The social pressure on trans individuals to come out as an authentic self that one always was is reinforced by the ways in which gender has been integrated into the welfare state and the medical industry. This can be illustrated by the establishment of gender clinics, the pathologization of sex, that someone is born the wrong sex, and that must be corrected. This elides the extent to which it is an acquired desire, and that these forms have been socially constituted. Viewing gender as a corrective of sex is socially imposed and renders what ought to be private into a public concern. At the root of this problem is the taboo of childhood sexuality and the right of children to self-determine. Since the Neolithic era, children are treated as the property of their parents rather than treated as conscious actors. The idea that one was born the wrong sex further disempowers the child's right to decide for himself what emotional and erotic needs he wishes to express through his sexual instincts. In addition, the bourgeois desiderata I have outlined above, in order to dissolve the boundaries between trans workers and all workers, we would also need to depathologize and demedicalize the act of transitioning. At the moment, the psychological effects of transition on youth seems to be entirely imagined and not sufficiently proven in research. These studies ought to be carried out so that in depathologizing and demedicalizing transition, new forms of mediation could benefit the needs children actually do have rather than basing these needs on a taboo. The success of trans liberation requires the emancipation of all humanity. Trans individuals have to earn their freedom of their own volition and with the support of all who are oppressed and exploited by capitalism. It can't be handed down by oligarchs and medical executive officers, since this would only reaffirm the state machine, nor can it be achieved through a trans nation or small radical spaces. The contradiction of capital is one between the social relations of bourgeois society, which require us to work on one hand, and the forces of production which make work superfluous and promise to advance the control of our relationship to nature on the other. The overcoming of sex by gender is itself a part of this process. However, at the moment, it is actualized in an irrational way. Relatedly, the desiderata of trans liberation has been known for some time. It is not impossible to realize this desiderata at a more universal level, that is, to fulfill the task set forth by bourgeois society. At the moment, in the United States, trans politics amounts to a more or less conscious capitulation to the Democratic or Republican parties. However, what is needed is the establishment of a party of the people and for the people, with the intent of purging the Democrats and the Republicans of their political power. The identity politics of the trans movement is an expression of the failure of such a social transformation. It is a form of melancholia, which internalizes the loss of the subjective element of this crisis, the death of the left. Today, when there is no objective appearance of this subjective element, when there is no left, we must resist this temptation to turn away from reality and simply supplement our degraded form of social being. Survival, being, must be lifted beyond itself. It should not be accepted that one must capitulate equally before everything that can appeal to this objective at the expense of a will to live better. What must be recognized and made conscious is the fact that all we have now, including sexual identities, is in fact our own self-reproduced fetters. As Karl Marx said, it is not the consciousness of men that determines their social being, but their social being that determines their consciousness. At a certain stage of development, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production. From this development of the productive forces, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins an era of social revolution. Thanks. That's it.
Thank you. I'm going to take questions if someone wants to ask. Otherwise, I'll have questions as well. Do you want to?
Yes. This question. You used the term identity politics several times, and I think in the American context, it's quite clear for people what it means. However, in the German political context, it's quite hard to grasp. To be understood under this, so maybe you could elaborate a bit what you exactly mean with identity politics, especially because you said it's an obstacle to socialist politics.
Right. So identity politics tends to be appealing to voters or political actors on the basis of their identity. So a good example is the Democratic Party platform. There is like these WikiLeaks that came out that kind of showed kind of the internal racism of the Democratic Party, in which they built their constituencies based on these identities and appealed to them as those identities. So for example, they were like, we'll have to talk to Latinos this way because they're Latinos. And oftentimes the appeal is trying to understand and give expression to people rather than actual political demands. But in a much more, like, that's like the most recent example in the US that I can think of, but in a more general way, I think something that like Richard has said, which I agree with, is that like before the bourgeois revolutions, there was only identity politics, meaning like what else did people have except for the identity of their community and their group. And then identity politics in bourgeois society takes a strange form in the form of nationalism. So like it's a more general problem, but it takes like a specific form in capitalism, I guess, in which it's it could provide the opportunity for change, if that makes sense. But not like because identity politics has a potential for identity politics is an obstacle, but like specific, I guess, like, I don't know. I'm kind of like,
I guess, like, identity politics, rather than looking on, like, what people do in society, focuses on what people are, if they are black or women, rather than what they do. So Adolf Reed said this famous thing, like if you sort of succumb to identity politics, we could easily live in a society where the 1% of like capitalists are like constituted like 15% black, 15% women, 50% women, 15% like a transgender, and that would still be a just society if you succumb to the logic of identity politics. So there could still be like the 1% who rules the society, but they would be constituted along those lines, and you would still have a just society. So that's like identity politics.
Yeah. Another like example would be like Reed, like that Reed illustrates is from his work on the Jesse Jackson phenomenon, in which the like after the civil rights movement, there's like a crisis of black leadership, in which the black managerial class starts to integrate the black proletariat on the basis of an authentic black identity. So Jesse Jackson appeals to this sense of authenticity, but this authenticity is tenuous and is kind of imagined, but it plays a productive, it plays an actual role in the sense that people actually believe it, and it's and like a, it's an ideological force that, that is an obstacle. But, yeah.
More questions or comments? Okay, then I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Okay, you talked of the regression of society behind liberal bourgeois rights, and that like gaining, for example, bourgeois rights for transgender people would, at the moment, like in the absence of socialism, mean like to affirm the state machine. Mm-hmm. But do you see this like I mean, there is no left, there is no socialism right now. Wouldn't it still be, wouldn't it still be like? Isn't it still? Shouldn't we still welcome like gay marriage or like, you know, like those bourgeois rights?
Yeah,
and
definitely.
The second and the second question was. In the Feinberg, pamphlet, A Movement Whose Time Has Come, Transgender Liberation.
Right.
She talks about transgender being like predating oppression, and you said that in your talk. Mm-hmm. But like, what would it mean? Because she talks of transgender identities being. Being like tolerated in ancient society, right. And that the, for example, the this was like rooted in the peasantry, for example, and that the Catholic Church and like with sort of with the emergence of like private property, sort of and the family and the nuclear family, these sort of this was like sort of tabooed and like pushed out of society and like the tolerance sort of like this shifted, and and then she seems to make the case, like what would be the case today? If is it possible to make the case for transgender people and like transgender being recognized as something legitimate and like something that like people can do whatever they want without saying like without conflating sex and gender and without saying like gender is involuntary or something like that and like recognizing that there is a potential in capitalism. Which she doesn't like Andrew or no sorry Leslie Feinberg doesn't and like say make the case for this to be like make the case for like transgender people being like not just tolerated but we sort of living in a society where which like resembles the society she described with like ancient society without going back without going to a time that predates capitalism because capitalism actually has proven that there is like the sort of has like if you could like explain on the progressive character of that and like with capitalism we have like the material means of making people like you know what you talked about hormonal replacement or like you know passing actually passing into the other gender and like and yes this is like but of course due to I would say ideological reasons, this is not being done. So I would be interested in what you say sort of on the basis of capitalism and like overcoming this problem, if that's possible, without pandering and going back to, you know, like ancient communism or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, primitive. Okay.
Primitive communism.
So I feel like, if I recall correctly, the first question, the first question is like, so if we have, like, if Donald Trump, like, makes it legal for, or like Hillary Clinton, whoever, makes it legal for like trans people to have access to jobs and like fair equal use of like restrooms and marriage rights and child custody, like that would be great because it would be like that would help dissolve the barriers between the working class, between transgender people, men and women. So it would make it easier to organize like a socialist politics in that situation, if that makes sense. So like it's not like on the principle that they're bourgeois ideals, but it's like there's a practical element of consideration there, maybe. And as to the second question, I think you're getting at like how, what's new in capitalism, like what's right, and like how to not return to primitivism or primitive communalism. And I think like what Feinberg misses, the contradictory character of capitalism. I think Feinberg misses that there was a limited amount of autonomy in the First Enlightenment, meaning like I think, like, which in the actually that it historically, like the private property relations of the family were historically necessary in developing that contradiction of potential. Right, because it develops like the critical conscious, like of the individual, the bourgeois individual, and the ability to conceive of, like, I mean, it basically amounts to subject-object relations, like, and the ability to act on nature and transform it. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, let's see, I think, like, though, like, so I think Feinberg also, like, isn't able to grasp her own ability to go back into the past, in a sense, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. the fact that she can go back into the past and, like, have this reflection and relies on the ability, like, the productive knowledge of society, the objective knowledge mm-hmm. of society. And so, to some extent, like, that's part of this problem as well. Like, there's a contradiction between the past and the present, mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the past appears as a task, and you know, having empathy for that past, I'm sure primitive communalism was had its highlights, but like that's not going to change the present, if that makes sense. So the way forward would be and specifically like in general, it would be like realizing labor and obviating labor, but like in particular to. I mean, that's it. Yeah, I guess, like, yeah. That's what it's saying. But, yeah. Thanks.
Stefan?
Okay, one thing in German first. Wenn irgendjemand irgendwas fragen will oder so auf Deutsch, kriegen wir es bestimmt irgendwie hin, das zu übersetzen, inhaltliche Nachfragen oder was auch immer. Nur, weil es jetzt die ganze Zeit auf Englisch war. So I just told there could be questions also asked in German as we were trying to translate.
Okay.
Thanks for the talk, Monsieur. I was fascinated with one point which you were opening up, and that was that in the beginning of the 20th century, in modernism, mm-hmm. after the socialist revolutions in Russia and mm-hmm. in Germany, that there was like a broadening of freedom for people who were not conforming to the gender norms at that time. And you told that it was institutionalized mm-hmm. in society through pathologizing it. Yeah. So on the one hand, we have like this gap that in theory, there's like the idea that there's like a natural difference between these people,
yeah.
but this pathologizing, making it like a point of not being correct, was granting them more freedoms than there were before. And then, as if I understood you correctly, you were talking about the 80s concept of the authenticity mm-hmm. Of transgender.
Yeah.
And that this, if I understood you correctly, was coming into conflict and into contradiction with actual practices mm-hmm. of trying to struggle for rights of people who were feeling in the way which we would now call transgender.
Right.
So this seems to be like a mirror image of what happened in the beginning of the 20th century.
Exactly, yeah.
Could you elaborate a little further on where you see the similarities between these two shifts?
Yes.
And also where the differences are, and maybe, if you can say so, what this could say for our moment politically for the question of trans liberation and its obstacles.
Right. So in response to your first question, I compared what happened in the Weimar Republic and the institutionalization to as being similar to what happened in Russia in the 1930s, but contrasted both of those examples from what happened in Russia in the 1920s, which still benefited from the advances in German science, but like was qualitatively different in the sense that it was like it wasn't pathologized. It was dealt with as bourgeois right, if that makes sense.
And in the beginning of the Soviet Union.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so I was like, that's it's an important distinction to make, right? And then which answers your second question, the similarities in the 80s. I think yes. I think like some people have tried to deal with this in terms of the fact that they're mired in the identity politics. They tried to understand it in terms of like, well, like male to females will always be more oppressed than female to males, or like because of the association with prostitution, whereas like female to male would be always associated with like having a job. And so like these are common attempts to try and understand this similarity. Like these things were similar between the two, but I think most, what is similar I think is this issue between concepts and what's conceptualized, meaning rather than just practically allowing people to do as they wish, there's a furthering integration and expansion of state power, if that makes sense, and like medical industrial power, I think the older forms also offer more as an educational tool, an educational object, because I think that they are better expressions of this contradiction, especially because of their proximity to the revolutionary moment in 1917, whereas later on you get individuals themselves who embody these contradictions and are quite incomprehensible, if that makes sense. And so it's almost like that would be right, and then, but like knowing that, like how does one move forward? And I guess it would be, the question is like, could people who are invested in this movement like be? This is like a virtual argument too, because there's no left. Like, and this is a part of the problem, right? Because like, the idea of like even considering this as an obstacle to socialist politics is a virtual, like it's virtual imagination at this point. So I think it would depend, and that's like an unsatisfactory answer, but we haven't reached a point where people are practically considering like a left movement, like a workers' movement, for an international workers' movement for socialism on a mass level yet, if that makes sense. But
if I can follow up on it,
mm-hmm.
my question maybe also too broadly is because you were speaking of exactly that there's not a vital left, there's no like leftist politics which is trying to bring about socialism,
mm-hmm.
and with this we are so to speak stuck with thinking about what bourgeois right we could try to introduce to help people who are suffering under transphobia, maybe so to speak. I think because most of the times it's not an argument for transgender, but against transphobia.
Yeah.
And so this was bringing up for me this thought that when in the beginning there was a pathologizing, which we would take as something bad, so to speak, because it puts pressure on the individual.
Yeah.
But this, in fact, guaranteed more of the health of people, of their of the security of their existence.
Yeah.
While now, there is like this big movement for acceptance of transgender,
right.
But at the same time we see uprisings against it. And not only in places which we in Europe would see like regressive, like in Russia, but also there were big movements against it in France and also smaller movements against it in Germany.
Right.
So that was my question, maybe about how the situation has changed for trans liberation politics in capitalism itself, even without the left, which is trying to pose a broader picture and more opportunities.
Yeah, I think like the example of the new left is informative in the sense that so the gay liberation movement that began in like the late 60s,
mm-hmm.
Often like at first there is like trans activists, there's like NAMBLA, and there's other, like there's all kinds of like what would have been called in the 20th century like sexual deviants or abnormal sexualities, who were involved in the movement. But as it, in the 70s and 80s, as they became more of a legislative force, they would push out these other groups that were more taboo. I think it goes back to that question of like the sexual taboos, if that makes sense. And which, right, like they come out in the same way that like the disintegration of the family opens up these possibilities in capitalism, that's also where the taboos are coming from, if that makes sense. And another, I guess, illustration of that is like this contradiction you brought up where people are, like in the early 20th century, pathologizing it was like giving it meaning and integrating it within the state for some people. And people even show, like the words that people use to describe themselves today were invented by like sexologists and psychoanalysts who were inventing these words for their patients and in a conversation with them, trying to give them words that they accepted. Like, and this is kind of like, there's like a memory of this maybe, like, in the activists today who want something similar, and you see there's like something like on Tumblr, if you go on Tumblr, like you'll see that there's like 56 genders or something, and people are just like trying to express these like pathologized conditions on themselves, and it's kind of like I think that issue is obscured to the issue that like they're pathologizing themselves is kind of obscured. And I think like there are conversations around depathologization, distinguish myself from those like calls to action, because what they kind of mean is like use different language in the health services, and what I'm trying to say is we need to try and understand like what this actually is on a more fundamental level in like the childhood, like in childhood development, if that makes sense. So it's like, yeah, but anyways.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else, questions? Okay, no, then I have questions.
Okay.
Okay, you also quoted Binya Adamczyk, I think, the mm-hmm. There's an article in the PR, an interview, or in the Platypus Review. And Binya Adamczyk talks of similar problems that you've been addressing here. And
right.
That's why, yeah. So the question would be, because we've been talking about identity politics,
right.
Like my first question would be if you could, because this is not clear for me, if you could like show the connection or like how these moments like of the Weimar Republic and like Stalinism mm-hmm. that you were talking about,
right.
And like the treatment of this transgender identity question
yeah.
speak to identity politics later on, like in the 60s and 70s, and so what basically the reality we live in today,
right.
And then also how identity politics today is an obstacle to socialism, which you've been saying, but like maybe elaborate a little bit further on this.
Yeah.
And then also, like a problem, what I see that I see in the Binya Adamczyk article in the PR is that seeing, like, and recognizing that sort of with the shift and like with after the Russian Revolution, like that the family loses its sort of productive function, and like this is like the case, she says, like in capitalism, like once a capitalist industry is able to provide cheaper textiles, food, and so on and so forth, and then like the family loses its sort of the nuclear family loses its productive function, and there's a crisis of the family, and the crisis of hierarchical divisions of labor, but this she says, like the task of socialism would be to sort of socializing the remaining functions of the family, and this she says did not happen at all. Like she says, like rather than the socialization taking place, what happened was a nationalization. And with this, she sort of refers to of course Stalinism. But in a way, sort of confuses Leninism and Stalinism. So whether or not you could talk a bit more about this, how this concretely looked after the Russian Revolution, how sort of the socialization of family, tasks was achieved, and the limits to that, and because this would be like I think of a relevance for today if we talk and think about socialism and say that this would be something that could be solved in socialism, and the question of this being addressed and solved is not.
So that's very hard to follow you at all because you're having this.
Sorry. Yes.
Very long question.
I have
Sorry, I was just asking first about how those two moments of Stalinism and identity politics later on, how they sort of how they speak to each other, and then the second question was how Binya Adamczyk speaks of the nationalization of the family, the tasks that the functions of the family after the revolution, they were not socialized, but that rather nationalized. And I feel like she conflates Stalinism and Leninism, and I wanted to know what sort of how the situation looked after the revolution, and whether or not, because Kollontai, he's.
If I can break the lance for her here, because I talked to her about it, she doesn't think she conflates it, but for her it's the same. She says it's authoritarian, and that's the problem with authoritarianism. For her, it's the same, and for her, Trotskyism also is the same. Mm-hmm. So that's her opinion.
Yeah, but they were this is completely
I think I could
Yes, but still, I want to know because nationalizations happen, because the welfare state and all those things you talked about, I want to sort of...
Right. Well, I guess if it's okay if I start to answer.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, because there's a lot on the table. But I guess... there's two... I think there was three questions you asked. The first and the last are actually related. They're both about Binya Adamczyk. I would say what Stefan said, it seems she's anti-authoritarian. But I would also say, you asked about what specific ways did the Russian Revolution socialize the functions of the family, and so that would be in the communal rearing of children, but also it's the Bureau of Love, which was if people are familiar with it was young women who hadn't been married could sign up and find someone to marry. So I think there's an extent to which the socialization of production could happen outside of a revolution conceivably as well, because we can think of Tinder, for instance, which serves a similar function. And so it really raises the question of politics and the dialectic between liberalism and socialism in a way, because Tinder is not fulfilling, but maybe Tinder and socialism would be, not to be too vulgar, but yeah, I think that's a fun way to put it. And then you asked how is identity politics, Binya Adamczyk, was saying that the socialization of the family was its nationalization. And I think what's being missed there was the potential. That might have been the case, but there was a potential for the Russian Revolution to be an international revolution, had Rosa Luxemburg been successful. And so, there's it kind of elides the, like, I guess, seeing the, like, it avoids politics, like, if that makes sense. Like, one would, like, to take an anti-authoritarian stance would elide, like, the necessity of, like, a party, for instance. And I think, like, the other question you asked was, like, how is identity politics an obstacle? And I'd say, like, for this, like, I mentioned earlier, like, the social division of the working class. And so, like, for example, like, right, like, so, like, the civil rights, after the civil rights movement, like I mentioned earlier, like, the, like, referencing the Jesse Jackson phenomenon, that you could still have proletarian integration managed by the middle class. And, like, you said this very well with, like, the, like, if you capitulate to the logic of identity politics, you could have the correct portion of, like, according to the population of each individual group within all of the classes, and it would still, like, that would be fair, a fair and just society. And that's, like, that's an obstacle, obviously, for two reasons. One reason, because it reaffirms divisions in the working class, and the workers need to, like, realize their commonality as workers. Something that Lucy brought up at the CPGB conference that they have, Communist University, was that saying that it's possible that someone could be racist and participate in the revolution, which it, that is possible. And then second, identity politics is an obstacle because it's an argument against the necessity for the transformation of society, because it, like, I, like with the example that you brought up and I just mentioned about the, like, statistics, you don't have to transform society. There's no necessity to transform the totality. So, yeah, and I guess it satisfies a similar anti-authoritarian position, if that makes sense. Or, yeah.
More questions, comments? No? Okay. I can read, like, Reed's quotes on this, just to finish up. Like, if you want, like, Adolf Reed has a really nice, like, in the piece you send us, because he has been, like, a, like, sort of the voice of critique of identity politics being neoliberalism.
Right.
And unfortunately, he's now pro-Hillary. But if I can quote, he says, race politics, just to close up, race politics is not an alternative to class politics. It is a class politics, the politics of the left wing of neoliberalism. It is the expression and active agency of a political order and moral economy in which capitalist market forces are treated as unassailable nature. And then saying this is like what sort of people, like, in the Jenner and Dolezal debate, what they did was centralizing political discourse, and in which gender identity must express, and I'm quoting again, a condition as natural or inherent, equivalent, or prior to biological sex type. And with this, I think he touches upon issues which you have been trying to sort of touch upon, like the issue of socialism and liberalism. Mm-hmm. And this connection not being like there not being a disconnect. Mm-hmm. And also saying, and this is the last thing, I don't know which one of those I can, also the debate also throws into relief the reality that a notion of social justice that hinges on claims to entitlement based on extra societal ascriptive identities is neoliberalism's critical self-consciousness. In insisting on the political priority of such fictive, naturalized populations, identitarianism, which you mean identity politics, meshes well with neoliberal naturalization of the structures that reproduce inequality.
Right. Yeah, I guess, like, if I could just, like, respond to those Reed quotes really quick. I think Reed's helpful in the sense that, like, the Dolezal Jenner issue could, like, make apparent the ineffectiveness of identity politics. And I also think that he's longing for, I think, like, his argument that's being implied there is, like, to have political economics in response, like, of, like, the New Deal welfareism or like the old left, for instance, in response to this like neoliberal identity politics. But like in a sense, I think there's a potential for like workerism in that, which would itself be
problematic.
Yeah. But right. So I guess like, does anyone have any questions after that? But yeah. No.
Questions, comments? No.
Okay. Cool. Thanks. Thanks
thank
for coming.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.